This is Chris McGregor. The work of Discerning Hearts could not continue without your prayers and support. Between now and December 31st, please consider making a year-end tax-deductible gift. Click Donate at either discerninghearts.com or inside the Discerning Hearts free app. Your generous support will allow us to continue our podcast for those on the discerning journey. Thank you and God bless from all of us at Discerning Hearts. DiscerningHearts.com presents Pathways to Sacred Mysteries with Dr. David Fagerberg. Dr. Fagerberg is a professor of liturgical theology at the University of Notre Dame. He holds an MA from St. John's University, Collegeville, and an STM from Yale Divinity School, and a PhD from Yale University. His books include Theological Prima, On Liturgical Asceticism, Consecrating the World, Liturgical Mysticism, and Liturgical Dogmatics. Pathways to Sacred Mysteries with Dr. David Fagerberg. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. David, thank you once again for joining me.
Nice to be back.
I have to tell you, in our conversations, I have been enthralled. I'm going to use that word, enthralled, with your definition of liturgy. Liturgy is the perichoresis of the Trinity, canonically extended to invite our synergistic ascent into deification. What I love so much about that definition is that I don't want to use the word challenge, because I don't think it's a challenge. It's an invitation to dive deeper into the mystery of those words. Because for many people, the words are going to be like, what? We're so used to easy words. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. And sometimes theology becomes boiling down 50 gallons of sap to get a gallon of syrup. And my definition was an attempt to condense things. How thick, I hope not turgid, but how dense a definition of liturgy could I come up with? The idea of perichoresis was playing in the back of my mind, this making room for the other, reciprocity, the descent and ascent, the exitus and reditus, that was playing on my mind, the kenotic act of self-emptying that God does in the incarnation, and the kenotic act of stepping outside of himself to make created creatures alongside his uncreated self. All of these things are flowing on my mind, and it arrives eventually to our sanctification or deification. So the definition has a swoosh, if I can steal it from Nike, descent and a rising again. But the main purpose of the definition is to make our understanding of liturgy to be connected with a great, grand salvation history that God is effecting, rather than connecting our liturgy to Kiwanis Club and birthday parties and rituals that we make up for our clubs. This is not the Jesus Club that we've established, and then we get together and kill a Sunday morning. This is the activity of God in the cosmos, with an eschatological goal in mind, that whole activity of God now made present in a ritual, sacramental, liturgical, ceremonial form. So we step into the liturgy and out, in and out, in and out. This is what Corbon calls the ritual liturgy and the lived liturgy.
That entering into the liturgy and receiving the invitation to walk through, to become a part of something bigger than us. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, we seem to have on occasion this relationship sometimes, I think, that image of Jacob wrestling with the angel. We hear that with the struggle with even, you know, should I go to the liturgy, or I don't like what's happening, or the homily is not good enough, or the song that was sung didn't touch me, or it irritated me, or they were doing something wrong, and the head gets in, and it's like this grand wrestling we do with not only what we may feel is what should be happening, but then what we see in others. And then we wrestle with, you know, what are they? Do you know what I'm getting at? There's instead of the church entering into this, there seems to be a lot of struggle and wrestling.
When I was at the Liturgical Institute at Mundelein, though for a brief time, the rector then, John Canary, said to his seminarians, go to liturgy to pray, not to criticize, not to critique, go to liturgy to pray. I tried once to describe liturgy by a certain term that I thought was playfully inviting, but the journal editor in which I was trying to publish the piece insisted on striking it. I think of liturgy as a trysting place with God, because the definition of tryst in the dictionary is an agreement between lovers to meet at a certain time and place. Exactly. Mm-hmm. What else is liturgy but an agreement between lovers, human and divine, to meet at a certain time and place? So then you can talk about us entering into liturgy, but I guess what liturgical mysticism is about is liturgy entering into us, because we become the temple, the dwelling place of the persons of the Trinity. Christiformation, becoming shaped over after the model of Christ, the image growing into the likeness of God, holding the Spirit within. This is the liturgy, is the Holy Spirit acting, Christ acting, the Father acting, and that enters into us. We have a tryst with God. Now, if you wanted to soften the sorts of complaints that we often make about liturgy, it would be like, I haven't seen my wife for a year. She's been deployed overseas. I'm making this part up. She's at home right now. but I'm seeing her again, and we go out to dinner, and we have our tryst, an agreed meeting place between lovers, and all I do is complain about the silverware and the water glass and the service by the waiters. Yeah, that can dampen a romantic meal, but that's not what makes the meal romantic. So do the rubrics, be attentive, be cautious, be careful, be focused. But there's something deeper going on here than what we normally complain about.
Well, we've discussed the perichoresis, and that canonically, that action that's happening, that circulation of love, can we say, that's happening. There's also, as you point out, the ascent. There's an ascent that happens. Mm-hmm. And you use the term automatos. It means the self-acting, moving, or acting on its own.
That stuck in my mind because I had once read metakos means power, like a power to move. And automatos means self-acting. Automobile means I don't have to get on a bus with a bunch of other people, but I can drive myself where I want. This is auto movement. Movement by myself, for myself, by my own power. And the point being made here by Louis Boyer is that nothing happens in liturgy automatically, by my autonomy, by my power. You have to be filled with grace and inspired, moved by the Holy Spirit in order to commit liturgy. Since liturgy is a verb, I often refer to it as committing liturgy. Mm-hmm. That's why nobody committed liturgy until after their baptism. You receive this infusion of the theological virtues in baptism in order to become a liturgist. You can't do liturgy without God having first entered within. And then you cooperate with God. He energizes, we synergize, we respond to him. This is just bringing Augustine and Pelagius into the liturgical realm as well. It's not an abstract definition of grace or works. It's a concrete discussion of, is it grace? Or does it involve our work? Well, both. But a synergy is two factors which are equal in necessity but unequal in power or value. God's grace is the greater value, but my cooperative response must be there as well. So no automation in liturgy. You know, you can start playing with automatic in various ways. And I hope that people don't go through the liturgy automatically. I hope they do it by heart, but automatic has a kind of sense of careless hypocrisy about it, or thoughtlessness about it.
Now, I'm recalling something I had read from a great contemplative writer, Sister Ruth Burroughs, who said, if you just spent your life contemplating the Eucharistic prayer, that would be enough. Mm-hmm. It is an automatic, but it's also you're preparing yourself. It washes over you in the liturgy when it's offered at the altar, but yet it's also something that you should be so steeped in by knowing that, being that, it becomes a part of you. Does that make sense?
It does, and that for me is the dimension of asceticism, steeping in, preparing for, being capacitated for. My teacher, Paul Holmer, used to talk about a difference between capacity, skills, and activities. And he said, you do activities by the hour. I'm going to play basketball from 2 till 3. And you do skills, you develop skills over a period of time. I can play basketball well or poorly. But capacities, he said, you do and develop over a lifetime. It's a capacity to be loving or hopeful or to have fidelity. So I could say, well, we'll flip it. One of the ways you could tell the difference is the oddity of putting some language on the other. I could say about the activity of reading, I'll be in the library reading from 2 till 3. But it would be odd to say, I will be understanding from 2 till 3. Understanding is a capacity. Well, my point is that liturgy is an activity, and there's certain skillful ways of doing liturgy, and that's what we apparently tend to talk about mostly in liturgical conversation, the rubrics. Liturgical asceticism and mysticism is wondering about the capacity for liturgy.
We'll return to Pathway to Sacred Mysteries with Dr. David Vackerberg in just a moment.
Discerning Hearts provides content dedicated to those on the spiritual journey. To continue production of these podcasts, prayers, and more, go to discerninghearts.com and click the donate link found there or inside the free Discerning Hearts app to make your donation. Thanks, and God bless.
Did you know that Discerning Hearts has a free app in which you can find all your favorite Discerning Hearts programming? Father Timothy Gallagher, Dr. Anthony Lillis, Deacon James Keating, Mike Aquilina, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and so many more are found on the Discerning Hearts free app. Did you also know that you can stream Discerning Hearts programming on numerous streaming platforms such as Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Pandora, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and so many more? And did you know that Discerning Hearts also has the YouTube page? Be sure to check out all these different places where you can find Discerning Hearts. We now return to Pathway to Sacred Mysteries with Dr. David Vackerberg.
Jungmann says somewhere that in order to do Eucharistia, you must become a Eucharistos, a thankful one. Before doing the activity of thanking Eucharistia, you must be capacitated as a Eucharistos. Well, why am I not innately, naturally, constantly in the position of thanksgiving? because of the passions, because of self-esteem, because of ego, because somebody hurt my feelings, because I'm just careless and reckless, and I wake up this morning without realizing that God has given me another day, which is undeserved. He who is being gives some being to a nothingness. That is a kind of meditation and contemplation, but it requires battle with the passions that would otherwise blind us. The asceticism is removing the cataracts of sin from our eyes so that we could see the world correctly, see it thankfully, see it with gratitude. So in the activity of the liturgy, one has an opportunity to exercise the capacities for liturgy. And that seems to me to mean that liturgy goes on inside and outside the church. I've got 7 days to prepare for the eighth day, the day outside of time, the day that will invade my calendar, the Kairos moment, the eighth day of resurrection. And I have 7 days to prepare for that. And then the contact gives me a jolt, like putting a live electric wire under my tongue, and it changes me for the next week. And that's the back and forth, the in and out that I detect.
Yeah, that Kairos moment. That's an important thing for us to contemplate, isn't it? That the difference from us being in Kronos, and we have the opportunity to enter into Kairos. Sounds like something you see on the Sci-Fi Channel. You walk through a portal, and all of a sudden you're taken back into a different land and a different place.
That's the way Lewis liked to talk about it. I always explain Kairos and Kronos to my undergrads with a quotation from the last battle in the Chronicles of Narnia. And Tyrion is thrown through a stable door to his death, but he finds himself standing in this bright sunny land with grass around him and a new set of friends. And he looks through the stable door, which is standing there, as just a door. There's no building, just the door standing there, like the models of screen doors at Menards. My kids used to like to go through one after another. And when he looks through the stable door, he can see the Narnia he came from. And then he says to King Peter, "It seems that the stable seen from within and the stable seen from without are two different places." "Yes," said the High King Peter, "its inside is bigger than its outside." And just in case we weren't paying attention, Queen Lucy pipes up and says, "In our world, too, a stable once had something inside it that was bigger than our whole world." This is what happens in liturgy. You go into a place whose inside is bigger than its outside. The eternal contact is made in this temporal, rubrical, cultic celebration. But what you're in contact with is something larger than that. Taft talks this way about Sunday. This is why it's important for worshiping on Sunday, the Lord's day for the Lord's people in the Lord's house at the Lord's table. Sunday is this eighth day, the day of the resurrection. After 6 days of creation, God rested on the seventh, and when humanity fell into sin, God had to act again. So Sunday, the day of the resurrection, is like one more day in the book of Genesis being added as an appendix. And Taft says, to anyone beginning the study of Sunday, the initial impression is one of confusion. Sunday is the first day, the day of creation, the day of light, the day of the new time. I think he's just named the cosmic dimensions of Sunday. But it's also the last day, the eighth day, the day beyond days, the day of Jubilee, the day of the end time. Now he has named the eschatological dimensions of Sunday. It's the day of the resurrection, the day of the post-resurrection appearances and meals. Watch for that in the scripture readings 8 days later on Sunday. It's the day of the descent of the Spirit and the day of the ascension. These are the historical Jesus days. And then he gives finally the ecclesiological church meanings, the day of the assembly, the day of the Eucharist, the day of baptism, the day of ordinations. Until one asks, is there anything Sunday doesn't mean? And the answer, of course, is no. For the early church, Sunday was indeed everything. The symbolic day, sign of the time of the church between ascension and parousia, the time in which we are living now. It's the day symbolic of all days for, and here's the quote which I stumbled on in our earlier conversation, so I can slip it in here. Mm-hmm. It's a day symbolic of all days, for the purpose of all Christian liturgy is to express in a ritual moment that which should be the basic stance of every moment of our lives. Once a year, you celebrate a birthday in a ritual way, but that doesn't mean you don't love your kid for the other 364 days. Once a week, you enter into this Eucharistic uplift and tryst with God, but that doesn't mean you forget about him for the other days of the week. What you do on Sunday morning should be an expression of the basic stance of every day, of every hour, of every moment. Well, that seems to me like an ascetical struggle and a mystical joy.
A friend I think we both have in common, Dr. Scott Hahn, when he approaches just from his viewpoint, his angle of seeing that liturgy, that Kairos encounter, the way he expresses it as he has entered into it through the book of Revelation and how that's celebrated, just the sheer manifestation of his explosion of enthusiasm about it. That's just one man's experience of what's occurring there.
Yeah.
And yet for it, not everybody is going to approach it from that vantage point, but they just know it. There's something that's happening there. I mean, he's kind of, from his position on the hill, this is what he sees.
Yeah.
That's valid, isn't it? I mean, as far as what's going on there.
Yes. Are you talking about a academic like Scott Hahn versus Mrs. Murphy, who doesn't have a degree in theology?
Thank you. That's what I was going for.
Well, there's an appreciation of poets, even though I can't speak poetically. But poets have a gift of putting language together in a certain way, and then they say things that I know, but I wouldn't have been able to express. There's an advantage to having an intellectual, an intellectus, somebody who's catching the vision of things. An advantage to having somebody intelligent, by which I mean lots of data, right? Intelligence mm-hmm. isn't smart. It's having read lots of books and having material. There's also an advantage to having the virtuous moral person who can describe the science of struggle and morality. But what they're describing is something that is a common gift to all Christians. So maybe we shouldn't speak so much about understanding liturgy, but about apprehending liturgy, which literally means to grab hold of. Some monkeys are prehensile. They have a tail that can grab things. Well, prehensile liturgists, could we apprehend, grasp? And yeah, you do that in all sorts of different ways. Now, it's nice to have somebody who could bring to bear the book of Leviticus and the teachings of Augustine and what John of Damascus was talking about. But that's a gift to the intellect that God has given to some. And as St. Thomas says, the intellect is the highest gift, and so God appreciates this, but it's not necessary in order to do liturgy. I was thinking the other day, I haven't gotten this written out yet, so I shouldn't have to backtrack on the recording. One of the first approaches to liturgical studies was, I'm trying out the thought, was with the intellective faculty. People read history books. They wrote up theological treatises on liturgy. How was liturgy explored? It was with the intellective faculty. Seems to me that a second phase of liturgical studies opened when people began considering liturgy with bodily faculties. And this one I put in the plural because it means looking at how people experience the liturgy. No longer a intellectual theory about symbol, but asking, how does the symbol affect us? How does it move us, change us? And music stirs our imagination, and we have tactile body contact experience with liturgy, and there's hundreds and hundreds of articles about ritual studies and ethnography studies, and how is the person experiencing the liturgy. So the intellective was talking about this understanding, and the bodily is talking about the experience of the person. And my reading in the last couple of years made me think that there could be a third faculty. And the concept was actually popped in my mind by material I was reading from Father Lieberman. He talked about interior faculties. Oh, intellective faculties, bodily faculties, but spiritual faculties, interior faculties. What kind of faculties would be required for grasping, apprehending, entering, being entered by liturgy? And those interior spiritual faculties might in fact be as important, more important, certainly more important to Mrs. Murphy than going off to do a master's in liturgical theology at Notre Dame. Oh, Mrs. Murphy, I wish you could worship better, but you have to come and do 2 years of school here first. Well, that's baloney. So the spiritual intellectual faculties, well, what I've really named here is what the tradition, in the ascetical tradition, names as three eyes, E-Y-E, not egocentric eye. Mm-hmm. There is the intellectual eye and the physical eye. The first is what you mean when you say, oh, I see. That's mm-hmm. referring to my mind seeing. The mind has an eye. The body has an eye. But the tradition talks about developing an eye of the heart, a noetic eye. Noesis is mind, but it's not the brain kind of mind that the West generally talks about. It's the mind down deep in the heart. And so then when you participate in any liturgy, I think that you should be seeing it with all three eyes. Is there a fourth? I don't know. I haven't gotten beyond the three yet to write them up. But this idea of a liturgical spirituality, the spiritual noetic eye that would let one see, that might have some value to it.
You're sounding very Benedictine there.
Did I?
Isn't that one of the first lines in the Holy Rule of St. Benedict is, listen with the ear of your heart. I would say he would say, see with the eye of your heart as well, wouldn't he?
Yeah, I suppose so.
You've been listening to Pathway to Sacred Mysteries with Dr. David Fackerberg. To hear and or to download this conversation, along with hundreds of other spiritual formation programs, visit discerninghearts.com, or you can find it within the free Discerning Hearts app. This has been a production of Discerning Hearts. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. We hope that if this has been helpful for you, that you will first pray for our mission. And if you feel us worthy, consider a charitable donation, which is fully tax deductible, to help support our efforts. But most of all, we hope that you will tell a friend about discerninghearts.com and join us next time for Pathway to Sacred Mysteries with Dr. David Fackerberg.